The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this episode are that of the guest and host and do not necessarily reflect the values of sponsors or other associated organizations. Welcome to the Parental Compass. I am your host, Bobby Williams. This week, as well as every week, we are brought to you by Family Education and Support Services. They are doing revolutionary work to educate families both in Thurston County and beyond, and you just have to appreciate them in this effort. As always, please look us up on Spotify, Apple Music, or if you want to, you can go to our website, parentalcompass.org. And OMG, we have a great show today. Now, this is a really serious episode. We are going to be talking about suicide and depression. What are the warning signs? And once you see the warning signs, what are the next steps? Here to discuss it with me is Scott Hanauer. And what I appreciate about Scott is that his perspective is very clinical and what we in the field call evidence-based. He's not just going on emotions or what he thinks is the right thing to say. You know, he is basing his answers on his experience, what studies have shown, and what he knows works. Later in the episode, Scott mentions QPR trainings, and I just wanted to give you this information up front. Anyone can do these trainings, and the goal is that they will teach you how to approach someone who might be suicidal. You know, what are the questions you ask? What are the next steps? You could potentially save a life through this training. For more information, please go to familyess.org/QPR. Sign up. It's important. In other news, we have a new member to the team. New team member, Molina Healthcare. They are sponsoring the show through their Molina Cares program, building strong communities one life at a time. The goal of this program is to fill the unmet needs in healthcare, which is exactly what we're here to do with this show. Mental health is health. So thank you to Molina. All right, let's get into it. Scott Hanauer, suicide prevention. Buckle in, there's a lot of important information here.
They predicted what the impact of COVID would be on behavioral health issues. And they identified things like an increased anxiety, increased depression, problematic substance use, and suicides were all going to go up. And they even, drilled down to like sleep disruption is going to be a problem for people. Mm-hmm. So, and those things turned out to be true.
Yeah. It's an unfortunate prediction then. What I think can be confusing about suicide is I remember being a teenager and just being, you know, pretty depressed. And I think depression is a relatively common thing for a lot of teenagers. And so it's hard to tell, like, where is that line of, are they really suicidal? Are they just dealing with normal teenage depression? So what are the warning signs, or how can you even tell the difference?
Sure. I think it's important, particularly during the pandemic, that parents and adults listen for the language that kids use. And some of the indirect warning signs are things like, it wouldn't matter if I wasn't around anymore. Nobody's going to have to worry about me. It wouldn't matter if I was around anymore. Those are kind of the indirect warning signs that the risk factors are higher. The more direct warning signs or, you know, the direct language the kids use of, I'm thinking about killing myself, I'm going to die. My own experience working with young people who have attempted suicide is that they didn't want to really die. They just wanted the pain to go away. They wanted the depression and the anxiety to go away.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing when you're going through a severe depression, it just feels like nothing can get rid of it. You know, you can't just eat an ice cream sandwich or something. It's just hanging with you forever. Right. And you touched on something interesting of anxiety. And I know there's a difference between depression and anxiety. And anxiety is almost worse in a way, right?
It is. I think my own experience with kids who have attempted suicide or thought about suicide was it was more driven by anxiety than it was depression. And part of that is because anxiety seems to have a specific pain associated with it that is, you know, young people have described it's unbearable, it's oppressive. They live with it 24/7 and that they can't make that pain go away. And they don't really have any hope that the pain will go away. So, you know, the language I've heard from young people is that they didn't want to die. They just wanted to go to sleep and not wake up. And that they just couldn't see living their life for the next, you know, 40, 50, 60 years with that pain and feeling that that's what their life had in store for them was to live with that pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's like, it's one thing to say to someone like it's going to get better, but to know that inside is a difficult thing, especially right when you're in the middle of it.
Yes. And I think with, you know, the pain that comes with depression and anxiety is that people lose perspective. They forget when their life was better, for example, or that they believe that it's never going to get any better and that there's no hope.
Them. And your frame of reference is shorter. Like I think of myself as an adult and when I'm going through a difficult time, I can look back on like, okay, well that year was a difficult year, that one, but I got through it. But if you're 14, 15, you don't have that long, you know, frame of reference to use.
Yes.
What about, you see these warning signs, what are the next steps then? How do you intervene and start to do something about it?
Sure. So, you know, listening to the language is very important. What we talk with adults about and parents about is to be an empathic listener versus a problem-solving listener. And empathic listeners have that ability to keep kids engaged with them and to be able to communicate that the adult gets it, that we all know and can relate to what it feels like to be sad or down or worried or anxious, and to be able to communicate that that the adult understands, and at the same time persuading them to get help and to stay alive.
Yeah. Well, you want to feel like your child can say anything to you and feel comfortable with you, but that's not the reality for a lot of parents. How can you start to get more of that open dialogue going?
Yeah, one of the statistics that we learned even before COVID was that about 50 to 60% of 10th and 12th graders have anxiety and worry that they cannot make go away. And a majority of those kids said that they did not have an adult to talk to when they were stressed out. Mm-hmm. And our task force, which is called Thurston Youth Alive, did some focus groups with young people. And we asked them about that. We said, where's mom? Where's dad? Where's grandma and grandpa? And they fundamentally said two things. One was that they already saw the adults in their lives as so stressed out that they didn't want to add more stress to the adult's life. So the lesson there is that it's important that parents model resiliency. We don't want to see our kids, we don't want to have our kids seeing us as so stressed out that they can't come and talk to us.
How can you model resiliency?
Oh, I think a lot of ways, making sure that, you know, we take care of ourselves as adults, that we're doing pro-social activities, that we're moving, that we're outside. One of our colleagues at the University of Washington, who's a molecular neurologist, says that the single biggest thing that we can do to build resiliency is 150 minutes of aerobic exercise a week.
Yeah.
So to just move. And if parents don't move, if kids don't move, to get them outside to do that.
Yeah, I think a lot of kids don't like the idea of therapy. Like, you think of it as like, oh, I'm going to this office, it's boring. It just makes me feel like, at least I know when I was a kid, I was sort of like, well, I got to double down on not being into this for some reason. And I think that's just a common thing. But therapy isn't always what kids think it is, right?
Right. I think one of the myths about therapy, particularly among young people, is that somebody's going to get into their head and make things even worse, not better, that it's not going to be helpful. And that it's, you know, that they're going to dig around in, the therapist is going to dig around in the young person's past and make them, you know, remember things that they really don't want to remember. But what we know now is that's not the therapy that works. The therapy that works is skill building therapy. What can young people do to make the symptoms of depression and anxiety less?
It's almost sort of like a coach to work with you a little.
Yes. And there's a stigma. And young people just, they don't want to walk into a mental health office and sit in a waiting room and for fear that they may see somebody who knows them. So we're looking at therapy as much as possible, being home, you know, in homes, in schools, in communities where nobody has to, there, you know, it reduces the stigma of being in a mental health office.
Totally. Are there other myths that we need to dispel, or common suicide myths that are out there?
Yeah, I think there's a lot. One is that if an adult, the myth is that we want to dispel is that if an adult talks to a young person about suicide or brings suicide up, that somehow that's going to plant the seed. But what we know now is that the seed was planted a long time ago. A lot of times young people are thinking about dying before the adults even notice. So we want to dispel that myth that somehow talking about suicide is going to plant the seed. In fact, my experience talking to young people about suicide is that they're actually relieved that an adult brought it up and said, finally, somebody noticed.
Yeah. You know, we've talked about this issue before, and it seems like suicide is an impulsive act. There's this 10 minutes that's really intense, but if you can just get through it, talk to me a little bit more about that idea.
Sure. I think that what the data tells us in the research about suicide is people, particularly young people, have been thinking about dying for a while. And then there's a point at which they're most impulsive. So the impulsivity may be driven by using a substance or having something even more negative happen in their life, where there's some research that says there's like a 10-minute window of impulsivity. And if we can intervene in that 10 minutes, then the chances that somebody's going to attempt suicide goes down.
Yeah, substances are a huge piece of it too. I think about, you know, we were talking about pop music before the interview, and the idea of being medicated is sort of a thing. Like, you listen to, at least I listen to raps with like DaBaby or Wiz Khalifa, who are, you know, into like being stoners, and they'll say in the songs like, I'm heavily medicated. And it's interesting that they're saying medicated, because that is what it can be sometimes, is self-medication. Talk to me a little bit about that, about depression and self-medication.
Sure. I think when young people are anxious and they're worried a lot and they're depressed, that they're looking for any kind of a relief. And sometimes substance gives them a relief in that brief moment of time, where if they drink for a while, that somehow their mood is lightened up a little bit. The problem is those substances actually increase impulsivity, and that over the long term, it actually makes depression and anxiety worse. But when you're desperate in the moment, you'll look for anything to relieve the pain and to make the anxiety or the depression less by just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to think long term when you just want the pain to go away.
Yes.
Even if, yeah, I mean, alcohol is a depressant, so you'll probably be more depressed the next day or the next few days.
Yep. Yes.
Speaking on relief too, another thing that can be popular in teen culture is cutting. And that's actually almost kind of a self-medication too, in a way, or what's going on there?
It is, to some degree, that there is some research that indicates that young people who cut, that it actually is a stress reliever, that it increases endorphins for a brief moment of time. So it actually makes them feel better for a moment. Just like if they took a drink for a short period of time, it lightens their mood a little bit. But it's also an indicator that somebody is really struggling.
Yeah. Hmm. So let's say, you know, you notice your child is cutting themselves. They come to you. I'm really depressed. Sometimes I have suicidal feelings. What do you say next to that kid? You're the parent talking to the child. Let's walk some parents through this.
Sure. So continue to ask questions. Again, be an empathic listener. And empathic listeners have certain competencies. And one of them is that they prioritize listening to their children over other things. And that if their child comes and talks to them, it's important that they stop and listen to what their child is saying to them. And then to keep asking questions, keep them engaged. We talk about using door openers. And door openers are statements like, I didn't know that. Tell me more. What else do I need to know? What's the rest of the story? Who else knows about this? Anything that we can do to keep a child engaged with a caring, empathic adult is really helpful. There's also some research that indicates that when children receive empathy, particularly from their parents, it actually brightens their mood. It increases dopamine a little bit in their neurological system so that it does make them feel better. So keeping young people engaged when they're struggling is really important.
Keeping that conversation going. I appreciate that.
Yep.
Well, what are other resources there for parents, you know, Thurston County and across the country? Where can people turn?
The National Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is 800-273-8255. And people can call Family Education and Support Services at 360-754-7629 and sign up for what we call QPR Suicide Prevention Training. And QPR Suicide Prevention Training is about a 90-minute training that teaches people the warning signs, the risk factors of suicide, and then what questions to ask, how to persuade somebody to stay alive, and where do we refer them for services. QPR is kind of analogous to CPR for coronary events. If you're trained in CPR, you know what to do to keep somebody alive who's having a coronary event. You're not their doctor, you're not their cardiologist, you're just keeping somebody alive. And QPR teaches folks how to keep somebody alive.
Wow. Well, Scott, I'm glad we just had someone so informed to talk about such an important issue. We're not talking about it enough.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here, Scott. I can say firsthand, I have seen the lives that Scott has impacted, including my own life. So take these words to heart. Scott knows what he's talking about. On behalf of Family Education and Support Services, Molina Healthcare, and myself, Bobby Williams, this has been the Parental Compass. We'll see you next week. Peace!